Welcome back to the CTO Playbook, the podcast dedicated to helping CTOs excel. What if the problem with your hiring process isn't what you're doing wrong, it's what you don't even know to look for? Most CTOs leading engineering teams are not indifferent to this. They want diverse teams. They believe in it. But belief without examination tends to produce more of the same, and nobody tells you why. I'm your host, Adam Horner, coach to CTOs from startups to enterprises, helping you lead with clarity, confidence, and strategic impact. If you feel like you're figuring it out the hard way, you're not alone. That's why I created the CTO Playbook, a podcast and platform built for tech leaders just like you. Explore coaching, cohorts, and how you can stay ahead at thectoplaybook.com. My guest today spent 2 decades leading globally distributed engineering teams, became the first female director of engineering at her company, and left it with 50% women in that role. She then went back to university to put the evidence behind what she'd already seen on the ground. We sat with some of these ideas together at CTO CraftCon in London a couple of weeks ago, and the conversation was good enough that I wanted to bring it here. She's unusually calm about uncomfortable truths, and that is exactly why this matters. Michelle, welcome to the CTO Playbook. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me on, Adam.
Before we get into anything structured, I just wanted to start really simply. Can you tell us a little bit about where you are right now and what you're spending most of your time on?
Yeah, so I have set up a business called The Leading Place. And really, the mission is about supporting organizations to build workplaces where both people and performance thrive by reimagining what leadership looks like.
Cool. And so what does a sort of a typical week look like? What's sort of the scale and shape of teams that you're sort of normally working with?
Yeah, so like it can vary. I've done a few talks. I've been on panels. I've been on a few podcasts. I run a lot of workshops. I do one-to-one coaching and mentoring. And also I would sometimes work with companies on their strategy. You know, they come to me with, this is the challenge we're seeing. And my thinking really is often the presenting problem isn't the problem. So often people will tell me about a problem and then we kind of dig into it and do a bit of discovery and realize actually it may be something a few layers down. So that's really what I spend my time on.
So sort of digging down through the layers of what runs an organization, what makes it tick, to go looking for the challenges. I mean, do you often find one single smoking gun, or is it sort of a more complex web of symptoms that you find?
One of the topics I'm really interested in is trust. And, you know, alongside that is psychological safety. And it's something that I managed to create in the teams that I led. It's hard. But I think if you're willing to hear stuff you don't like to hear and, you know, you're able to actually create an environment where people can share things that maybe challenge you, you know, you can actually start to build the trust. My general thinking on trust is trust begets trust. So if you start with trust, it builds it. And I think that's also kind of connected to positive psychology. So that's one of the things that comes through my leadership programs, but also the way I led teams in software engineering and really starting with trust and creating that environment where we actually can have hard conversations.
And so what sort of transformation or difference does that bring on the other side of it? And what do your sort of clients look forward to once they've worked with you for a while?
You can do some surface level, short-term things that can help people, but really this is more long-term. And it kind of links back into coaching as well, the coaching mindset. And it's really around asking questions and helping people to understand what they can do differently. And it's not about me providing solutions, it's about me asking good questions. I heard somebody talk recently and they said, mentors answer your questions, coaches question your answers. And I think that's a really good way of thinking about how you, so my leadership style when I led software engineering teams was really about asking questions and asking things that would help others. It's, you know, if somebody came to me with a problem, I wouldn't try and give them the solution. I'd try and work it through with them and ask them questions. And really the whole thing underneath it is, it's trusting your inner knowing and actually unlocking what you already know. Often we know something. One of the things I actually ran a roundtable at CTO Craft conference in London. And one of the things we looked at was how I like to work. So communication and work preferences. But one of the questions in it is, do you think to talk or talk to think? And often we do know the answers, but because we haven't actually had a conversation, we don't even hear the answers that we know ourselves. So it's really unlocking that sort of thinking.
Yeah. And that's a really good one. Just also giving the breadth of the way that people work through things so that you understand why is this person saying so much? Maybe because that is their process of articulating and distilling what they're thinking.
Yeah, and actually one of the things that I encourage, because I've learned this the hard way, is if you do talk to think, to flag it, to signal it, signpost it. You know, so I would say, I'm just thinking out loud here, because otherwise people think you're a little bit crazy. You're just coming up with things, you know, you haven't thought it out and they're thinking, how could she even be thinking this? So I will say, I haven't thought this fully through, but I'd love to hear your thoughts. And I think, you know, often people say come with solutions, not problems. But if you come with solutions, that's one person on their own coming up with the solution. So I much preferred the approach of coming in to say, this is the challenge I see. Does everyone else see it the same way? Is there other things that I'm missing? And that also encourages psychological safety when we say, I know I don't have the full picture here, so I really need to hear from everybody. And, you know, creating that environment where we can talk through and realize, is this actually the problem? And then let's look at the solution.
Yeah, and this environment of sort of asking better questions, that's something that really resonates with me, because it's something I try and get people, leaders, into that mindset of. It's not about having the answers, it's about having, as you said, better questions that you can ask.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you think now of the environment that we're working in, it's so fast changing. Nobody can have all the answers. And if you think you can, you're wrong. You know, so it's much better, like it's co-creating sense-making together to get through the change in a more successful way. So it is that sort of thinking that none of us know the full answer.
Absolutely, absolutely. Michelle, what I wanted to do next then was to just sort of go back a bit, because your path to founding The Leading Place was not a straight line. And I think there's something in that story that's really relevant to what we're going to talk about today. Can you sort of take me back to your time leading engineering teams? What were those years like? What were the kinds of teams you were leading? And what were the challenges you're kind of facing up to at that time?
Yeah, it's funny. When you look back, sometimes you can actually see like recurring cycles of the same sort of things. And when I started in software engineering, you know, it was a long time ago. And I did actually work remotely since about 2002. So I worked remotely like one day a week generally, or had the option if I needed to do more. So that's one thing that I learned quite early. Actually having that flexibility keeps a more diverse workforce and a diverse team. It gave me options to stay in the workforce when my kids were younger, when things were harder. So I also saw, like, I had people in my teams that worked remotely, like, and came up to Dublin one day a month, and they were really successful. So, but I think, of course, that is being intentional. So I guess back then, we didn't have all the tools. Now we have a lot more flexibility. We have more options with technology, whereas we were on audio calls, you know, and I actually had a high-speed line when I started working remotely first, so it was kind of painful. But I think that you see a lot of repeated patterns. And like one thing I was actually just talking to somebody about recently was how there's a Michael Caine thing. He says, use the difficulty. So because I didn't come the normal route, I didn't do a computer science degree, and I came from a business role in AIB. And I sometimes thought, oh my God, I shouldn't be here. In fact, when I moved into when I was the development team manager in AIB, I'd messaged my husband one time and said, I'm in the wrong building. And he was like, what? Where are you? And I said, I'm at my desk, but I don't know if I should be here. And he was like, oh, for God's sake, they know your experience. You've just been interviewed for this role. And, you know, a little while later, my manager was going on holidays, and he said to me, I'll keep in touch, because there was some key projects going live. And I said, if you check in on me when you're on holidays, I'll know you don't trust me. So you better not. And I was only about a month in the role, and you could not believe all the things that went wrong while he was away. But we actually got through them all. And then that really built my confidence, you know, on you have to trust people. But one of the things we were talking about was how if you're a really strong technical leader, you often will not listen to other people, because you come in with, you think you know the best approach. And I did challenge somebody, one of my leaders at the time, saying, you know, you shut down that person's idea in that meeting. And he was like, no, I didn't. And then as we talked through it, he was like, okay, yeah, I see what you mean. And I said, he's not going to come with ideas next time, you know, so you need to be a bit more curious, ask questions, don't knock it, or else other people aren't going to be brave enough to speak up. So I think for me, because I came a different route, I was more open to asking questions, and that let other people's voices be heard. And because I have that positive psychology mindset, I start with what you're great at, working with you, with your strengths. So people have said to me, because of that approach, they achieved so much more because I kind of pushed them to, like, I believed they could, and then they realized they could do it. And that's been my experience myself with great leaders that have pushed me to do more than I thought I could do.
Yeah, and clearly going into that with a level of fearlessness as well, because I think coming up to anybody's boss and saying, you know, you shut that person down, it does sound like quite a potentially confrontational conversation to have had at the time. I mean, we're talking about investment banking, right?
Ordinary banking.
Banking environment.
Yeah,
okay,
banking,
still fintech,
financial services. Yeah.
Yeah, but, which can be quite aggressive scenarios, certainly known for those kinds of scenarios then.
Yeah, I think that somebody said to me one time way back in my career, your honesty will be your downfall. but I think that I'm not afraid to have those hard conversations because I kind of think, what's the worst that can happen here? And I had built, like, I build that kind of a relationship with people I work with where we can speak openly, and I value it a lot. So if I'm in an environment where I feel like there's hidden agendas and people can't speak up, I do not thrive, and I know I won't. So if I can't do that, then it's better that it comes into, like, we realize and we just say, this isn't working. The manager that I was working with was really open to hearing it, and he did listen. So, yeah, and it made a difference. So I think that's just really important. And actually, I have had the experience where people in my team have called me out on things. And I think it's really important to be able to go, thanks for the feedback. Let me just digest that without getting defensive. Because when you go into defensiveness, then people aren't going to share it the next time, you know?
Yeah, and it can be so hard. It's just that instant reaction. Just need to sort of calm it. Wait a second. I always say, you know, take a breath before you answer anything.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a reason also that they say sleep on it. You know, with emails, often when there's something really confrontational, I will say, I'm not going to reply today on that because I'm not going to give the best reply. So wait and see what your subconscious is going to tell you if you sleep on it for a night.
Solid advice. So, I mean, and one of those environments that we often find ourselves in is sort of looking for leadership ourselves and yet somehow end up being the one who's sort of providing it. Did you have scenarios like that as you came through in a sort of this transition from being the business focused to the tech focused?
Yeah, I think because I came from a leadership role in the business, I brought that into tech, but I also, like, I've worked with brilliant leaders and then some leaders that weren't so brilliant. And I think that I really feel passionate about that. That's why I have developed The Leading Place, because I really feel that leaders, the leadership shadow, people carry trauma from terrible leaders they've worked with. And we don't understand the impact we can have on people. Like, one throwaway remark can stay with somebody. In fact, this morning I was talking to somebody who said to me, oh, I remember, she used to report to me, and she said, I remember you said to me, that's good enough. And she said how impactful that was for her. And she said, no one had ever said that to me before. And it actually didn't make me do things to a lower standard. It made me be more creative, and it gave me the permission to be more creative. So I guess the thing that really frustrates me is lack of progress and, you know, when we're faffing about. And I guess one of the learnings that I had was because I didn't come the traditional route, I remember being interviewed for a role and saying, well, I'm not going to be like a principal engineer. I'm not coming in as an architect. I'm not going to tell you what the best technology is, but I know how to talk to everybody to get the best solutions and to come to the right decisions. But I actually think I did myself a disfavor. And we actually talked about this in the CTO women's group, where women often say things like that. And actually, you know, when you interview people, you often see women downplay their achievements and their strengths, and women or men can tend to overplay them. So if you're a man and you think everyone's playing by the same rules, you're going to think less of me because of what I said. And actually, I'm being probably too hard on myself. And when I look back, I have driven a lot of technical decisions, big strategic technical decisions in roles I've been in, when people have still said, oh, you're less technical, you know. So it's something to be mindful of, I think.
So rather than being sort of honest or putting yourself down, even if it's unintentional, it's really about being level about what you will bring and what you will contribute as a strength rather than mentioning areas where you're not so strong, because everybody has areas of weaknesses.
Yeah. And like, I think as well as part of that, how I like to work template that I was talking about, one of the questions is, what are your strengths and what are your strengths that go into overdrive? So instead of focusing on weaknesses, what we typically think of as weaknesses can be strengths that are overused, or we over-index on them. So, for example, I might think I'm really organized. That might be my strength. But if I go into overdrive on that, people might think I'm controlling. So you actually then have the power to pull that back a bit, you know, and yeah.
Right, so it's not about calling it or labeling it as a weakness. It's about reframing it as this can be good, but it can be over good.
Too much of it is not good.
Yeah. Too much of a good thing is never a good thing.
Yeah.
Cool. And so in terms of that then, because we're talking about lots of different ways that people think and lots of ways that different people lead. And because I know that one of the things you've done a lot of work around is the equity, the equality, having the balance of teams overall, whether that's from a gender perspective, from a skills perspective, from a background perspective. But one of the things that's often the most striking and the most spoken about in software engineering circles is the gender imbalance. And so there must be stories you've got from yourself are coming through that aren't necessarily just, you know, about you and your experience, but certainly about situations where there's been an imbalance, but the imbalance has been caused by something that people were completely and utterly oblivious, that they were creating the situation.
Yeah, and I guess just even before we talk about experience, I'm not sure if everybody knows the history of women in tech, and actually, you know, women actually were... they were computing. And, you know, if you look back to the history, it was seen as women's work and men weren't interested until it started to show more potential. And men then started to get interested. And actually, I've written an article on where did the women go, but it's really on the history of, there's a few waves of where women were pushed out of tech. So now when I really feel that we need to talk more about women that actually had such an impact in the past in tech. You cannot be what you cannot see. You can, but it's much harder. So if people think that this is normal, it's not. So, you know, coming
it's
with
not
that,
even normal by historical norms. That's what you're saying as well.
Yeah. And one of the people who died last year, Stephanie Shirley, but she went by Steve Shirley, because she got into rooms because her name was Steve. And she was in her 90s and she had a huge impact. But one of the things she did was she set up a software company when there weren't even, you know, it was more hardware. And she hired a lot of women who were being not getting flexibility in the workplace in tech. And it was really, really successful. I think she had 8,500 staff at its peak. She donated millions to tech, she set up to an autism charity as well. I think what was interesting when I was researching her was I came across a picture of her, of one of the people who worked for her, working at a table in their kitchen, coding the black box for the Concorde. And she had her daughter sitting beside her. So back in the 60s, this woman provided flexibility, remote working, when now we're finding people saying, oh no, it doesn't work, we need everybody back in the office, you know. So I think she really led the way and she was hugely, hugely successful. And what she said about equality was, when the equality laws came in, we actually had to start hiring men. So it was quite interesting. But I think from my own, you asked me about my own experience. In my last company, I joined as the first female director of engineering. And when I left, we had 50% women in that role. So by being intentional, you can actually change gender representation. I think one of the things, you know, there's research on critical mass theory, which talks about you need 30%. So in a group of 10, you need at least 3 of like women or different dimensions of diversity for their opinion not to be seen as a woman's point of view. So you need more than 3. So if you do an interview and you've got one woman on the panel, it's likely that no women will get hired or promoted because the men think that the woman is covering the gender thing and the woman is afraid to be seen as positively biased towards women. So like it actually decreases the chance of a woman being hired if you've got only one woman. So when you have an only, that's an issue. And I have often been the only woman in the room and it is really difficult. So I think we need to be more mindful of who's not in the room, who's not on the team, who is not being, whose opinions are not being heard. And we've so many examples of products being developed that were, you know, that missed the mark for certain cohorts of society because there was nobody in the room, you know, to represent that need.
Yeah, and it affects everything from planning products, going to market, resonating with people. It affects the products themselves and how they're built, like physically in some cases, whether it's a physical product. There are some great stories around that. And I think one of the things that I mean, just going back to what you were saying before about the history of computing, having so many more women, one of the people that I think is very, that I love looking at anyway, Ada Lovelace, who was literally one of the first coders working on the Babbage computing machine, I think that's what it was called at the time. And she was the pioneer of a bunch of numerical algorithms that worked and still work to this day. Some of them not as efficient as current algorithms are being developed, but algorithms that stood for decades in terms of their efficiency and effectiveness. She came from a fairly privileged background to get into computing, but she was somebody who established, I think, that role model early on and then disappeared from sight for a long time. I remember having to really battle with some colleagues in one of my companies I worked in to get a meeting room named after her when there was other people on the meeting rooms. The rest of them were all men. Some of them, you know, rightly earned their places in the canon. But for me, I felt like she would be one of the key people.
Yeah, fair play to you. And also Margaret Hamilton. So she coined the phrase software engineer. And also she had her child working with her because she had nobody to mind the child one day. And because of something the child did, she uncovered a bug, you know, that was really, really, really important. I think, yeah, there's so many of these women, Hedy Lamarr, who created the precursor to Wi-Fi. You know, there's a lot of these women who have actually created really brilliant technology and inventions, but we don't even know about them. Now, we know of we hear more of these stories in more recent times, but still, there's so many of them.
Yeah. And this is one of these things where it comes back to this idea of, well, diversity for compliance sake versus diversity as a way to actually create advantage, either, you know, debugging that crucial thing or whether it is building a product that resonates with, you know, the other 50% of the society.
Yeah, and I think, you know, some of this goes back to the default white man. You know, a lot of things are set up with that in mind, and anything else is other. So it's not just about gender, it's all the dimensions of diversity. And seeing, you know, like, I know in Ireland, the lowest employment rate is disabled women. So, you know, if we have more people of different, representing all the dimensions of diversity in the workforce, we're more likely to build better products. And, you know, it's if you are a man and haven't had to think about those other perspectives, you're less likely, it's harder for you to actually see that there is a need for something, you know. So if you're in a group and if you have that, you know, psychological safety where people can speak up and share, I don't think this is going to work. That's your best opportunity. And actually, one of the, you know, I've had lots of conversations about this in tech. And sometimes I would talk to men who would say, oh, that's really interesting. I didn't think about that before. And then like days later, I might set up a team of just men. And you're thinking, well, actually, did you really listen? But it's nearly like they just, it's like, I don't think it's conscious, you know. So I think it's important that we keep having these conversations. And actually, you know, they say unconscious bias training is not successful unless you provide ways for people to actually deal with that. So I think it's like with food, if you say to people, don't eat that, it's bad for you, but you don't give them alternatives, it's very hard. So you need to actually give people ideas around how to do it. And that's, you know, I think that's really what you're trying to do with the playbook as well. Giving people practical toolkits to actually implement change is vital.
I see there's two things. One is you need to make it easier to do it than to not do it. That's part of it. And I think there's another aspect as well, which is, are we repeating the things often enough such that it doesn't just become, okay, I said it once, now you need to remember it and comply with it, which is basically not the right way to change a habit, right? And then the other aspect, which equally is important, is showing the differences. Now, the first time I really came across the impact of small changes was when I was recruiting. This was probably about 20 years ago now, so quite a long time back, where I created this job spec with my team, put it out there, and I got back a whole bunch of CVs, and guess what? Every single one of the CVs looked like me. And, you know, all the names you pretty much could have pulled out of the first chapter of the, you know, the first few chapters of the Bible of the New Testament. So, and I sort of looked at that and I thought, I've obviously done something wrong here. And I went to one of my colleagues. I said, what have I done wrong? Why am I going up the wrong tree? And he basically said to me two things. One, you got that word there and that word there. I think one was the word aggressively excited or something like that. So I sort of intended it as the right.
I'm not primed for that job.
you got it right. Exactly. It's that immediately, okay, I associate that with a culture that is not the kind of culture I want to work in. So there was a couple of things that were too opinionated and too... it was just the wrong kind of wording to put into something that's welcoming. The second thing was what I hadn't put in there. I hadn't put anything in there about mentoring, about support, about the environment that people worked in, all of which were true.
Yeah.
I just kind of forgot it and took it for granted you know, didn't think that people would use that as a distinguishing thing. So we made those changes. And lo and behold, the CVs that I got back over the next week or two were completely and utterly different. And so for me, it was like, oh, wow. It was this demonstration rather than just telling me. And that's one of the reasons why it stuck so clearly for me. And I think if we can get to the point where more people sort of see that kind of difference as a first-hand thing, then the lists and so on will have more impact.
Absolutely. And I have had exactly the same experience. I sat down with one of the guys I worked with and said, we've only had applications from men. We had one woman apply for a role. It was a senior software engineer role. And we changed the job specs between us. And the following week, we had three women apply and we hired two of them. So, you know, and it was just like, it took us an hour like to do that. It wasn't a big thing. And I know there's tools like Textio you can use as a free gender decoder, CatMadfield, I think it's called. But like there's ways that you can do this quite easily. And it's masculine words can be off-putting. And sometimes the words that are seen as masculine annoy me that they are seen as masculine. But there's like aggressive is one that would come to mind. So a job spec that I saw in my last company one time was ninjas. I was like, really? No, I don't think we need to put ninjas in a job spec. You know, there's just certain words that will put some people off. And why are we including them? And I think you're totally right. Like we underplayed some things like that support, the environment that's there. And I think the other thing is too many requirements and, you know, looking for this perfect person that isn't there. And we know women are less likely to apply if they don't have as many of the requirements. So we're already then excluding certain people. And, you know, I think also accommodation and accessibility, having things like that listed and saying that you can make accommodations for people. So thinking about who the job spec is not welcoming by, you know, by maybe excluding certain things.
And it's often just takes one other person just quickly run it over, you know, with you in terms of, you know, looking at it from that perspective. Even if they don't have a formal training or your kind of background, somebody just looking at it with deliberate perspective of who's going to be put off by this.
Yeah, and
just
I think
that much can help.
Yeah, I would, my energy tells me, like a guy rang me one time and said, would you be interested in this role? He started talking and I said, it's not really giving me any energy. Let's not waste your time. And like, he was kind of a bit surprised, but I was like, look, I just know I'm just not getting any energy from hearing what you're talking about there, you know. So yeah, I feel like we need to think about the impact of the words that we use, because they do really influence if somebody's going to apply or not.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, verbal cues, just like any conversation, we say that only 7% of our conversation is the actual words we use. The rest of it is non-verbal. Yeah. Basically,
yeah, how we translate it.
In terms of the changes that you've enacted and gone when you've gone into organizations and teams you've worked with, what are some of the smallest changes that you've seen make the biggest difference, the greatest impact?
So for me, flexibility. And like, you know, this, we have three universal needs, self-determination theory, autonomy, relatedness, and growth or competence. So if you don't feel like you have a sense of autonomy, that can make a huge difference. And even when you think about people, you know, being asked to return to offices, some of the people who are told they need to go in 2 days, we're happy to do that. But when they're told they have to do it, then that actually, you can see them grating against it. So like giving people agency, I think is huge. And with the teams that I led, I said, I trust you to figure out how to work best. I expect this. This is what we're, our vision, our goals. This is what we need to deliver on. I expect that you can work to create ways to connect with each other. And that doesn't, I'm not going to dictate how you do that, but you can figure it out. And if you are having a problem, if the team isn't delivering, if you're really running up against challenges, we'll sit down again and we'll figure it out. But starting with trust and allowing people to actually use their own creativity, you know, I think makes a huge difference. And I think trust is to the core of, you know, so like even within the engineering culture in my last org, I noticed that we had a quarterly review where people shared updates on what they delivered the last quarter, some of the enhancements they did to their processes, automation, whatever, and what they were planning to do the next quarter. But I noticed everybody seemed terrified going into these meetings. And I said it to the VP of engineering and he was like, no, I don't think so. And I was like, no, I really am sensing this. People just seem really stressed. So we, between us, talked about how can we create it a bit more, like we changed even the word. It wasn't called review anymore. It was check-in or something, you know, but we tried to create that environment where actually people felt safe to come in and share. And I asked, maybe, can we ask, like, what didn't go well? Like, what failures have we had on creating that environment where we can talk about that? But for me, it is like creating that environment where people feel safe to speak up and, you know, that they support each other. So one of the other things that I noticed was everybody was individually doing their presentations. And the people who reported to me, all the team leads, I asked them to work together to help each other and to vet each other's presentations before they came to the session. And that's like a double help for me. It's reducing the amount of work I have to do.
Which is always good, yeah.
But it's also helping them to support each other and to see that they're part of the same team. And actually, I really did see they were supporting each other more in the session. They were asking questions. They were like, you know, giving. And that whole collaboration mindset rather than we're all separately trying to achieve something. And I actually read an article this morning by Brian Elliott. He was talking about how AI adoption is either often it's like usage adoption rates or like an org level adoption. And really change happens through teams. So actually we need to help and we need to reward team change rather than individual change. And like, that's not a new concept, but I think when you're looking at AI, maybe it hasn't been considered enough.
Yeah, absolutely. I know, you know, I was just reveling in the fact that we've got this far through a conversation without mentioning those two letters, which we've been everywhere recently, haven't they? No. I think it's because it's a very good point, right? Because everybody's thinking about it all the time at the moment. Nobody's wondering, you know, how can we bring this in, which is effectively a significant amount of change for most of us in terms of the way we work, the tools that are being used, the way we think about things, how we collaborate. And as you say, that kind of autonomy, mastery, purpose gets shaken quite heavily when there's a significantly disruptive new tool brought in. And so therefore that way that people work together, help each other, collaborate, I think it's crucial because I think, you know, for me, I'm a big fan of looking at some of the 1970s leadership models like situational leadership, which is very much around this idea that you've got this great big hump to get over, the really difficult part of getting teams to fuse. And it's not about putting in rules and regulations and measurements, and it's about support. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of those things that's coming back right now with AI again, and that the more that you support the team through the growth, through the additional stuff, just as you mentioned, the easier it is for us as leaders because everybody's helping each other. But secondly, also because of the fact that people feel a much greater sense of control and autonomy over how they get to use and deploy these tools.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if you, the saying, show me the reward, I'll show you the behavior. You know, if we reward individual activity, then people aren't going to support each other to implement it. And then, you know, so it's thinking about the incentives as well, I think is part of it.
Absolutely. I mean, talking about that then, so what you've got put together with your leading places is a wonderful list of 10 things that leaders can do to broaden the talent pool. And it covers quite a lot of the topics that we've gone through today, unsurprisingly. But do you want to just take us through the 10 you've got on this list? Because we can also provide a link to a download for people to grab this for themselves, can't we?
Yeah. Well, I always start with data. So like, what does the data tell us? So like, if you think about, and this is something I repeatedly saw, percentage-wise, we had less women in tech, but overall, we were seeing higher percentage of women leaving against the basis that we had. And And often that is to do with culture and, you know, maybe lack of flexibility. Often you can say you have a flexible working arrangement, but then there's policies that aren't practices or you're punished. And, you know, Hee Jung Chung has great research on the flexibility stigma. So women that are men or women, that anyone who works remotely, there can be this thing that people think they're actually working. They're less committed. So, but women actually do face a stigma for working remotely. And we don't want flexibility to be just for women. We want it to be for everybody. And then it's a more level playing field. But looking at the data and understanding who's coming through your process, who's not even getting into it. We were talking about the interview and who's applying, who's not even getting there, who's falling out at each stage, and actually thinking about that and understanding that data. The job specs we talked about already, you know, and making them more. And like also some of the specs I saw were just like boring as well, you know. So make them like what somebody wants to work here. I think a learning mindset as well, like showing that you know, I've hired people that have come from lots of different backgrounds. Probably it's helpful that I didn't come the normal route either to be able to see that it's possible. But also, you know, if they don't have exactly the same tech stack, but they have shown their ability to learn quickly, you know, just be a bit more adaptable. The panel then, you know, making sure that they're trained and understand, you know, unconscious bias, understand all those things that can get in the way. And keep
educating.
So this
is the interviewing panel or the set of interviewers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like, there was somebody who, there was a guy who told me he had a great woman coming through for a role. And he said, I'm hoping that she's going to accept the role. And I said, how many women has she spoken to? And he said, actually none except for the recruiters. And I was like, because I wouldn't take that role if I hadn't seen any women in the process. And he said, oh God, okay, will you have a coffee with her? So I was like, I got punished for asking the question, but it was great. And she did take the role and she told me that was impactful. So, you know, thinking about who people are meeting. So in the panel, making sure it's diverse, but also that they are trained and they understand that they don't, like there's so much bias there, we don't even know. And there's internalized misogyny, women carry it as well. So we have to actually help people to do a good job when they're interviewing.
Yeah, it doesn't come naturally, does it?
No, like there's, if privilege is invisible to those who have it. So if you may not just be aware of the challenges that others have. And you know, we were looking at our tech test and I had read something about women often don't like doing a whiteboard exercise where someone's looking over their shoulder. So, you know, thinking about all your processes in the whole recruitment process, does it actually disadvantage certain cohorts? And noticing who's not coming through. So it's about going back to the data again to say, well, it seems to be more of the same. Referrals are great. They're very great. A great way for successful hiring, but they are often a repeat of more of the same. So people who were that are like you, as you said earlier. Also that thing of cultural fit. So the word cultural fit actually is, it can be hiring more people like you.
Yes.
So thinking of reframing that to cultural enhancement instead. Designing your hiring practices to make sure there's accessibility in mind and flexibility. And that's in your hiring, but also like when you do hire, when somebody joins the company, that you do have accommodations for people that need accommodations. You know, even if you think about neurodiversity, like often we favor open plan offices where people who are neurodivergent may not be able to focus as much. And we just have to think about how we give people the environment where they can do their best work. And, you know, often these things aren't even that hard, but we need to ask questions and make it safe for people, because often people won't share that they're neurodiverse because they're neurodivergent because they're actually afraid of negative
consequences. Yeah, there's a stigma that can go with it.
I think we're talking a lot more now about it, but like it still can be something people would be worried about. And it's not
Indeed.
Just that. And I think then auditing your tools. So understanding, like, if you're using AI, what's the impact, and do we understand who's not getting through? I can tell you, I've got so many anecdotal examples of people who are over a certain age not getting an interview. And my advice is always go and talk to a real person, because the algorithm doesn't want you. And we're missing out on so much experience. But people may not even know that that's happening, that those people aren't getting through if you're not auditing your tools. And then time and patience is the last thing, because people
say... It sounds
say,
so simple, isn't it?
They're all simple enough. But if you want to hire somebody quickly, if you want to fill that role really quickly, you'll probably not get as diverse a hire. So you need to think about who might need a bit more convincing, especially women may not, I haven't got that experience yet. I want to finish what I'm doing here. I always say that there's always something more to do, but maybe a new opportunity is good, to look at now. And I can't tell you how many women have said to me, I have so much responsibility. There's so many things going on. I'm caring for my elderly parents or whatever. I don't think I need any more responsibility here. But actually, if you're a good leader, you will support somebody through that and say, let's work on what's the priority here and how can I take some stuff away from you so that you can actually go for that promotion. Because we know that women do more of the unpaid domestic labour. So helping to create the conditions where they can actually progress is really important.
Yeah, and not only the conditions, but also the mindset where it's okay to progress.
Absolutely. And people who I have helped through that have come back to me to say thank you. They're loving their new role. They're able to be more strategic. They're playing to their strengths and everybody's benefiting, So you're not just helping that individual, you're helping the team that they lead. It's a very wide impact.
Absolutely. So to quickly go through those 10 again, then number one was data. Number two, job specs. Look for the inclusion. And you actually put a tool that people can look up in here. So do go get the download, because there's a quick and easy to use tool there. Number three, signaling a learning mindset. Number four, train your interviewing panel for inclusion. Have a diverse panel for interviewing. Number six, I think, is one of the ones I like the most, is be intentional. These things don't happen by accident. They don't happen with hope. Being intentional is important. Number seven, cultural enhancement rather than cultural fit. It's just one of those phrases to fix, and a lot flows from it. Number eight, designing an accessible, flexible hiring work practices. Again, being deliberate about it. Number nine, audit your tools and technology, audit your AI. I think it's important. We sort of got to the idea that their AIs, for example, can be biased in the way that they work and biased in the way that they happen, but so can a lot of the other tools. So audit that. And then number 10, which I love, time and patience. Rushing things will cause a narrower set of answers to come out.
Yeah, and sorry, I think I might have skipped over intentional when I was saying them. But the thing about intentional is actually thinking about multiple channels as well. So actually, if you keep going to the same places, you're going to keep getting the same people. So actually being really intentional about, for example, when I was hiring, I said, I want more female candidates. I just want them to be in the process. And I was told, well, that's going to be hard. Yeah, okay, we'll wait. We need to just make sure we're bringing more candidates through. And we got good at some dimensions of diversity, but I think we need to be intentional about all of the dimensions as well. I know we're talking about women in tech here, but it's all the other dimensions as well. We need to think about that and be intentional about that.
Yes, absolutely. Brilliant. I mean, so from that list, obviously, if somebody implements all of those, they're going to make an immense difference to the kind of variety of folks that they can bring into their team. Is there... And perhaps this is an unfair question. Is there any one of those you'd normally reach for first as sort of the single most important thing you can do on that list?
Well, I said I start with data. So I think that is something, it's harder maybe though. Sometimes we don't have all the data. People may not, even identity, we may not be gathering that information. But we have the data, we always have some data. So even knowing what we're doing is a good start, and it's a good way to measure then progress. I think the job specs one is very easy as well. We talked about, you could do it in an hour. So, and maybe I'm underplaying that, but, I changed a few job specs, but, if you start to have a template and a call to action in your job spec as well, where you say, if you don't meet all these requirements, but you're interested in the role, come and talk to us. You know, it's a simple thing that can actually bring more people into a conversation about it. But like even anything you do is going to be helpful. You know, as you know, it's accumulative and you start to make a difference. So, yeah.
Yeah, from my perspective, I look through the list and I think the one that I like the most is be intentional. Because I think it's a nice broad phrase that gives a very easy call to action on, you know, people just be deliberate about these things.
Yeah, and like overall from a gender representation perspective, I always say notice and be intentional. They're the two things that I call out. And you were talking about examples of things that changed. Marianne Seegert's book, The Authority Gap, is really, really interesting. And she's got a lot of data and examples. But one thing she talked about was how women get interrupted a lot. They get less talking time and their credit is often misattributed to somebody else for what their idea. And I spoke to the guys that I worked with in the last leadership team and pointed this out. And I asked them to try and notice. And they did start to notice and they did start to do things like, wait a second, I want to hear what Michelle was going to say. She was interrupted there. And that's so powerful if your colleagues will do that, you know. So, and they started to say, oh, yeah, I really like that idea. I think Michelle mentioned it earlier. So, you know, I think that's
really
powerful.
And that brings us back to one of the points that you and I were discussing amongst a small group at the conference itself, which is that it's everybody has a part to play in creating this change in the industry, in the roles altogether. And those simple things, you know, please don't interrupt. Let's hear from the people who haven't spoken yet. These can make an immense difference with just a couple of moments of thought.
Yeah, and I think that's really powerful that anyone can make a difference. And, you know, one of the guys that I worked with once shared like a podcast or something I'd done on a Slack channel. And he was a software engineer who just decided, I'm going to just shine the light on what Michelle's doing. So, you know, it doesn't matter who you are, what level you're at, everyone can make a difference. And I think that's absolutely vital to say thank you for highlighting that.
And on that note, that's a great way to say, please do share this podcast episode out with others as well, so they begin to learn more about this important topic in technology as well. Michelle, it's been absolutely wonderful speaking today. Thank you very much.
And you, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the whole episode. I appreciate your time. So just before you go, I'd like to ask you for a favor in return for putting together this episode of the CTO Playbook for you. Please share the episode with just one person who will appreciate it. Wherever you're listening, whether that is Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or another platform, sharing the episode will help more CTOs find the podcast and enable me to create more great content. Remember that you can find more information on thecetoplaybook.com. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode of the CTO Playbook.